your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Welcome to Sarah Health Radio with Dr. Sarah Rosenthal. All comments, views, and opinions expressed are solely those of the host, guest, and callers. In the next hour, Dr. Rosenthal and her guests cover both the common and the not-so-common health issues you want and need to know. Get your pencils ready. Here's your host, Dr. Sarah Rosenthal.
Hello, welcome to Sarah Health with Dr. Sarah Rosenthal, the program that reminds anyone coping with health problems we are not alone. The goal of this program is to discuss both common and not so common health issues with the experts who really know what they're talking about. I'm Dr. Sarah Rosenthal, your host. I have a long career as a medical journalist and am the author of over 30 consumer health books. I have a PhD in medical ethics and medical sociology and direct the program for bioethics and patients' rights at the University of Kentucky. Today, we are devoting our show to the subject of cancer and the environment. Our guests today are Dr. Ellen Hahn, a tobacco policy expert. Dr. Hahn is director of the Kentucky Center for Smoke-Free Policy and is a professor at the University of Kentucky Colleges of Nursing and Public Health. Then joining us for the second half of the show is Dr. Holly Swanson, a toxicologist who is an associate professor jointly appointed in the Graduate Center of Toxicology and Molecular and Biomedical Pharmacology, who is also at the University of Kentucky. Dr. Swanson will discuss the non-tobacco-related environmental toxins with us later in the show. So, Dr. Hahn, welcome.
Thank you.
I guess I'd like to start with the most obvious environmental toxin we just can't get rid of, which is tobacco. And I thought that you could share with us first some of the some of your concerns regarding the health effects of, I guess, what we're calling environmental tobacco smoke or secondhand smoke.
Right. Well, Sarah, first I guess the listeners need to know that environmental tobacco smoke or secondhand smoke is really a complex mixture of thousands of gases and fine particles that come out of the burning end of a cigarette and that is exhaled also by smokers and that non-smokers inhale. And it's really a toxic brew of almost 4,000 chemicals, many of which have already been deemed to cause cancer and are off the market. Some of those things are like DDT, arsenic, benzene, benzopyrene. I could go on and on, but lead, mercury, of course, nicotine. There's a whole host of cancer-causing agents as well as other gases and toxins that are in secondhand smoke. So many people know that it's a nuisance, certainly, and it burns your eyes and your nose and your ears and, you know, it makes you, give you headaches. But what a lot of people don't realize is that it is the third leading cause of preventable death in this country. And primarily those deaths are from heart disease, heart attacks, but the other numbers of deaths, and it's estimated somewhere between 50 to 60,000 deaths per year among non-smokers who have been exposed to secondhand smoke. And so the rest of those deaths really come from a wide range of cancers, primarily lung cancer and sinus cancer. A lot of people don't know that nasal sinus cancer is actually one of the cancers that's very prevalent as a cause of secondhand smoke, and cervical cancer as well. And the new one that a lot of people don't know about is breast cancer, and we're finding that breast cancer in younger, primarily premenopausal women, so women under 50, when you've been diagnosed with breast cancer before you're 50 years old, there is a very good chance, in fact, anywhere between a 68 and a 220% increased risk of developing breast cancer if you're a premenopausal woman.
Well, this is all very disturbing. And one of the things I wanted to ask you is, knowing all of the human health effects of tobacco smoke, why are we still so behind in getting the message out that smoking causes cancer? And yes, we should have policies that are smoke-free.
Right. Well, it is interesting because 20 years ago, in 1986, the U.S. Surgeon General issued the first report that conclusively, you know, claimed or showed that secondhand smoke was a cause of lung cancer. So we have known for 20 years, and it is a good, legitimate question to ask why we're not doing more and why we haven't done more. And I guess one of the answers, and one of the main answers to that, in my opinion, is that Congress, as well as state legislators, have been unduly influenced by the tobacco industry, and candidates, you know, running for public office, getting campaign contributions from tobacco industry and those who manufacture the product. And so there's been very little regulation until relatively recently in some states. Now, places like California, Massachusetts, Arizona, and there's some other states that have really led the way since the mid-'80s and early 90s in passing strong, you know, workplace policies that restrict smoking. But there are many states, in fact, the majority of states and the majority of areas in this country, people still go to work every day and they're exposed to secondhand smoke. So there really are very weak regulations even still. But we're making progress.
One of the fascinating things about your particular career and also where you're situated is that you're working on all of this in the tobacco state, as well as, and I believe Kentucky is still the number one lung cancer state
right.
in the country. So how? But you've been Kentucky recently passed anti-smoking policies that you still don't see in other states. So how? What has your experience been, and what are some of the challenges that you've been facing?
Well, it is a challenge here, not only because we grow tobacco, but we smoke it a lot. In fact, we lead the nation in smoking. About 28% of our adults are regular addicted smokers, and actually we lead the nation in middle school smoking. So we have a lot of young people who are smoking, and many of them start when they're 10, 11 years old. And so when you start that young, you become addicted very quickly, and it's very hard. If your listeners know, they've been former smokers or current smokers, it's probably the hardest thing you could do would be to quit smoking. So this is a very, it's a chronic disease, and tobacco dependence is a chronic disease that requires long-term treatment. But back to your question about how tough it was, we were very fortunate to have a lot of expertise here in Lexington, where University of Kentucky is located, and a lot of people who are enlightened about the health effects. We took a long time to educate the public about the health effects of secondhand smoke. It was probably a 5 to 6 year commitment where the local health department was very involved and the hospitals got involved and the key healthcare providers and the health insurance companies. And so we had a strong coalition of people that were very interested in this issue, and we took our time. We did it in very deliberate fashion. We educated our policymakers and the public in a very slow, deliberate way, and we were successful in passing 100% comprehensive smoke-free ordinance in Lexington, which was the first in Kentucky. Now, since that time, that was April of 2004 that it went into effect, Georgetown, Kentucky, which is just north of Lexington, has gone totally smoke-free, and that includes all of their workplaces, which is really the strongest law in Kentucky, one of the strongest in the nation. And then, of course, Louisville, Kentucky passed a partial law last November. Davis County, where Owensboro is, which is in western Kentucky, passed a partial smoke-free law in January of this year. And then our most recent success is Letcher County, which is in Whitesburg, Kentucky, which is way out east, eastern Kentucky, in the Appalachian region, passed a comprehensive, well, they haven't passed it yet. It went through first reading, but it'll be a comprehensive public place policy. But, you know, passing these laws does require a lot of expertise. It requires lots of commitment and persistence because the opposition is out there and is fighting every step of the way.
I guess what this is sort of a two-part question, but so what you're basically saying is that the first challenge and battle is to actually do an education campaign, because there are still large segments of the population that do not believe that secondhand smoke is has human health effects. Is that...
No, I think, yeah, I mean, yes and no to your question, to your comment. One is, yes, education is prime. That's very important. I think most people know it's harmful. I mean, I think anywhere between 90 and 95% of the population say it's not good to smoke and it's not good to breathe secondhand smoke. But I think what people don't understand is the seriousness, the severity, how serious secondhand smoke exposure really is. I think people think it's just a nuisance and it makes your clothes stink and it makes you want to go wash your hair, you know, but people don't, and they put up with it when, you know, for instance, they go to a restaurant and they'll put up with sitting in a smoking section. And they think, well, I can put up with it. You know, it bothers me, but I can put up with it. People don't realize they're putting their health at risk when they do that.
So when you're, so the uphill battle to get a lot of these policies, the smoke-free or the sort of Clean Indoor Air Acts passed, what are the arguments that sort of the naysayers have? How do they defend not doing it?
Right. Well, primarily the tobacco industry and their allies, which are primarily the hospitality industry, the alcohol industry, perhaps the gaming industry, those are the industries that are typically the folks that oppose these laws. And what they typically say is really two things. One is that it's a business owner's rights and that the government has no business telling us what to do. So that's the first argument that they'll give you. The second argument is that they have cooked up this argument that somehow businesses are going to go out of business or lose business profits or revenues as a result. And there really are no scientific peer-reviewed journals, articles that would prove or even begin to show that there are economic losses as a result of these laws. So,
in fact, I've read the opposite, that that in fact business in some places actually increases.
That's true, but by and large the empirical evidence says that generally it doesn't matter.
We're going to have to take a break
okay.
Now. I'm hearing my music, but my guest is Dr. Ellen Hahn, a tobacco policy expert who succeeded in getting anti-smoking laws passed in the tobacco state of Kentucky. For more information about the primary prevention of cancer and environmental carcinogens, we suggest starting with my book, Stopping Cancer at the Source, available on Amazon. When we come back, we'll talk more about the tobacco wars and more on the human health effects of environmental tobacco smoke or secondhand smoke.
You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Your Health Press is a publishing company that specializes in unique books and hard-to-find health products, topics that mainstream publishers ignore due to rarity, stigma, or controversy. Looking for books on thyroid cancer, early menopause, ostomy, or other rare or embarrassing conditions? You'll find lots of unique topics at yourhealthpress.com. At yourhealthpress.com, all of our books are available exclusively online or via toll-free ordering, so you can purchase in privacy. No cash register syndrome or special ordering from your bookstore or library. Your Health Press titles are available at all online bookstores, including Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com. To browse the Your Health Press catalog of titles, search the list of authors, or purchase, visit YourHealthPress.com. For toll-free ordering, call 1-888-232-4444. Your Health Press, prescribed reading for today's niche market.
Stay mentally, physically, and emotionally fit with Younger Every Day. Hosted by Dr. Bob Payson. Broadcast every Friday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Younger Every Day will offer you alternative solutions for a variety of health issues, all backed by clinical, scientific, and medical data. Dr. Payson and other expert guests will inform and inspire people of all ages to look and feel better. Younger Every Day. Think clear. Feel strong. Grow Younger with Dr. Bob Payson, right here on Voice America Health and Wellness.
Hi, my name is Aaron, and I'm a survivor of mannequinism. Mannequinism is basically when you turn into a hard plastic shell that saves from not being politically active. For me, it started when I didn't register to vote. And then I stopped volunteering, and before I knew it, I wasn't doing anything. And that's when I found a small patch of plastic on my right shoulder.
Protect yourself from mannequinism. Log on to fightmannequinism.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
A fresh look at today's health. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Welcome back to Sarah Health Radio with Dr. Sarah Rosenthal. If you have a question or comment, dial 866-472-5792. Now back to the show. Here's Dr. Sarah.
Hello, we are back. I'm Dr. Sarah Rosenthal, your host. Welcome back to Sarah Health with Dr. Sarah Rosenthal and our discussion of cancer and the environment with Dr. Ellen Hahn, a tobacco policy expert. So where we left off, we were talking a little bit about the uphill battle with getting some of these indoor or clean indoor air acts passed. I thought that maybe we could spend some time talking about how this a clean indoor air affects quitting strategies, as well as what the health effects are on workers with secondhand smoke.
Right, and that's what these laws really are. Smoke-free laws are really common sense strategies to put in place that communities can put in place to protect workers and patrons, but primarily workers. You know, this isn't about really consumers as much, but it's more about the people that don't have the choice to go and work elsewhere. And many times in the United States today, the healthcare, the occupations that are disproportionately affected by secondhand smoke exposure are the food service industry, the hospitality industry, and given what I mentioned before about breast cancer being caused by secondhand smoke exposure, primarily in younger women, those diagnosed before they're 50, I think it really is a call to action for us to think about the young women who serve in the hospitality industry, and there are many. A lot of them are in college or young adults, young women in their 20s and maybe early 30s, and they're being exposed every day they go to work to the equivalent of almost a pack of cigarettes. It's estimated that if you work 6 to 8 hours in a smoky bar or smoky restaurant, you're essentially smoking about 16 cigarettes, which is almost a pack of cigarettes.
That's very disturbing. I mean, I guess what we're really saying, which you don't hear as much of as we probably should, is that when we're talking about secondhand smoke, it's really an occupational hazard. It's a huge occupational hazard.
It's huge. And not that I want to leave men out, but with this new finding that we're really now becoming to understand that breast cancer is actually caused by secondhand smoke exposure, or one of the causes of breast cancer, I think, you know, there are very few modifiable risk factors for breast cancer. There's very little women can do or have been able to do to prevent breast cancer. And so if this is one thing that you could do as a young woman is to avoid secondhand smoke exposure. But more importantly, it's another reason communities need to pass these laws to protect all people, of course, including women. But, so there's a whole host of occupational risks that, you know, we have all kinds of regulations. The government has given all kinds of regulations to protect the workers. And this is just another one of them that I think is huge and really important. Before I mentioned how the naysayers often say it's a right of businesses, but to be honest, it's really, at least in Kentucky, you know, our Kentucky Supreme Court ruled that it is the role of government to protect the public health, and this secondhand smoke is a significant public health problem, and so it is the role of government to protect the public health. And it isn't and shouldn't be a business decision. It should, you know, if it is all about public health.
How does, in terms of the role of government in discouraging smoking, what is your sense of the role of tobacco taxes?
Well, actually, the highest impact strategy for reducing smoking is increasing the price. So increasing tobacco taxes is number one, and a close second is smoke-free laws. So really, those policy changes are the things that change behavior in the long run. So it's just like anything. The higher the price, the lower the lower the likelihood that someone's going to do the behavior because they can't afford it. Now, certain population groups are even more susceptible to higher prices, like young people, like poor people who are impoverished, women, are more price sensitive. Rural populations are more price sensitive. So those populations that are exactly the ones that are most vulnerable, are the ones that will benefit from an increased taxes.
So it's definitely something that health promoters are in favor of.
Absolutely.
The higher the price, the greater the deterrent, and the lower the price, when we make tobacco less available and discourage smoking in public places, does this work as a quitting strategy for those who smoke?
Yeah, and that's a really good question. Absolutely it does. In fact, there are studies after studies showing that when people ban smoking in their home, for instance, they're more likely to quit. So if they have a rule at home that nobody can smoke inside and people have to step outside to quit, it makes it, less convenient to smoke, and people tend to give it up and find help to quit. We also know that people smoke less when their work site bans smoking. They may not quit altogether, but they smoke less, therefore reducing their risk. So not only do smoke-free policies and laws protect non-smokers from secondhand smoke, but they also help smokers reduce consumption and ultimately quit. So that's a real added, kind of value-added benefit of passing smoke-free laws, because it can help people quit. And, a lot of people don't realize how much money society pays for allowing secondhand smoke in public places. It's estimated that every year we spend $10 billion in the United States taking care of people who are sick from being exposed to secondhand smoke. That's $10 billion. So, we could save a lot of money. We could improve quality of life for so many people if we would take this, and these are very simple measures, really. It's easy to pass. Smoke-free laws are one of the easiest things to enforce. They're very self-enforcing. You take the ashtrays out, put a sign up, tell people they can't smoke inside, to go outside, please, and most people comply.
And that's basically an easy way to save $10 billion.
Absolutely.
Are smokers aware of how their smoking affects their health insurance? Is that something that you have some inside knowledge on?
Yeah, smokers are very aware. Smokers are very knowledgeable. They know that it's a serious health hazard. They know it costs money. But the truth of the matter is, Sarah, that this is an addiction. Tobacco is a very serious addiction, and people forget that because it's a legal product. They kind of forget that it's a serious addiction, like alcoholism, in effect. We don't turn our backs on alcoholics. We try to get them help, and it's the same thing with tobacco addicts. They need help just as well, and so they know. It's not a matter of knowledge. The key symptom of addiction is denial, and so people who smoke really are in a state of denial as to how much harm they're causing their loved ones and their friends and their customers, if you will, if they smoke inside.
What are some of the, you had mentioned that we know that in a lot of cases people get addicted when they're young, they get addicted when they're children. I know there's a lot of stuff that's been written about women and smoking, and how smoking is often, young women begin smoking as a weight control device.
And boys, too.
Mm-hmm. And in boys as well. What do we know about smoking and children and adolescents?
Well, we really should know more than we do, but there's still lots of unanswered questions when it comes to children. We do know that children get addicted quickly, very quickly. In fact, in just 2 weeks, some studies have recently shown that children who are smoking when they're young, if they regularly smoke for 2 weeks, they can be addicted at that point. So it doesn't take long, you know, from when you're experimenting with your friends out behind the barn, you know, smoking, you know, and in just a few short weeks they could be established smokers, because a lot of kids just do it, they experiment with it, it's something they see their friends or their siblings or their parents doing, and they want to be grown up, and so they do. They also, when they see it as a norm, in other words, when communities don't have very weak laws, kids may hear about it in school that it's bad, or hear from, you know, their parents it's bad, but if they see everybody doing it in public places, then that message is very clear to them that it can't be that bad. You know, why is everybody doing it if it's that bad? So it's a real cultural norm that we need to change, and I think these laws actually change societal expectations so that, you know, kids don't start and they don't even become established smokers as a result.
Now, are we seeing, I imagine that we're seeing less in recent years of tobacco companies sponsoring fashion events or sponsoring sporting events, or has that gotten better, or is it about the same?
Well, actually, the tobacco companies are spending more and more every year. Last I saw, it was $15 billion a year marketing their products. Now, it's gone up sky high since the Master Settlement Agreement in 2000, where they, you know, were supposedly cut way back on what they could do. Joe Camel was gone, and they couldn't put up the billboards. And, of course, years ago, they were banned from advertising on TV. So the general public may think, well, they're kind of gone away, and they're not marketing their products, but they're doing it in very interesting ways, like Internet advertising is very big.
How are they doing it on the Internet? What are they doing?
Well, you know, pop-up, you know, ads, for instance, for cigarettes everywhere. And, in fact, a lot of sites that children go to, they pop-up advertising. Now, there's starting to be more restrictions on that, but Internet's one. Point of purchase is huge. You know, where cigarettes are sold, they do a lot of advertising at point of purchase, and a lot of it's at eye level, right where kids are. And, in fact, some of the agreements that tobacco companies have with retailers are that they have to put the products at a certain eye, you know, height, and they do that so they can get to children. And so it's more subtle than it was years ago, but they're still reaching. They still have a lot of magazine ads. If you open some of the magazines, for instance, or some of the women's magazines, I mean,
There's our music. We're going to take another break. We're talking to Dr. Ellen Hahn, a tobacco policy expert who succeeded in getting anti-smoking laws passed in the tobacco state of Kentucky. Joining us next, Dr. Holly Swanson, a toxicologist at the University of Kentucky. For more information about the primary prevention of cancer and environmental carcinogens, we suggest starting with my book, Stopping Cancer at the Source, available on Amazon. And when we come back, again, we'll talk more about, we'll have a discussion about other environmental toxins with toxicologist Dr. Holly Swanson. For further information, visit me online at sarahhealth.com. All shows are archived on our site, as well as at Voice America Health and Wellness Network at voiceamerica.com. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Your life, your health, your network. This is Voice America Health and Wellness.
Your Health Press is a publishing company that specializes in unique books and hard-to-find health products, topics that mainstream publishers ignore due to rarity, stigma, or controversy. Looking for books on thyroid cancer, early menopause, ostomy, or other rare or embarrassing conditions? You'll find lots of unique topics at yourhealthpress.com. At yourhealthpress.com, all of our books are available exclusively online or via toll-free ordering, so you can purchase in privacy. No cash register syndrome or special ordering from your bookstore or library. Your Health Press titles are available at all online bookstores, including Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com. To browse the Your Health Press catalog of titles, search the list of authors, or purchase, visit YourHealthPress.com. For toll-free ordering, call 1-888-232-4444. Your Health Press, prescribed reading for today's niche market.
Women, do you feel that you're too old to be active, too old to be beautiful, too old to have fun, or too old to be fabulous? Well, if that's what you think, then there's good news for you. You're wrong. Tune in to Voice America every Wednesday at 8 a.m. Pacific Standard Time for Aging Outside the Box, Fabulous Women Over 50 with Shirley Mitchell. Aging Outside the Box is a fabulous, fun program that gives you every reason to feel greater than you ever have. Host Shirley Mitchell and O.E. Cruiser Small will cover phenomenal topics such as women's issues, health, diet, exercise, nutrition, faith, travel, and many other concerns for women of all ages. Feel young, feel smart, and feel fabulous by tuning in to Aging Outside the Box. Fabulous Women Over 50 with Shirley Mitchell every Wednesday at 8 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, right here on VoiceAmerica.com.
Opinions, options, answers. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Welcome back to Sarah Health Radio with Dr. Sarah Rosenthal. If you have a question or comment, dial 866-472-5792. Now back to the show. Here's Dr. Sarah.
Hello, we are back. I'm Dr. Sarah Rosenthal, your host. Welcome back to Sarah Health with Dr. Sarah Rosenthal and our discussion of cancer and the environment. Joining us now is Dr. Holly Swanson, a toxicologist at the University of Kentucky. Welcome, Dr. Swanson.
Thank you, Sarah.
We were just, in the first half of the show, we were talking about the most obvious environmental toxin, which was tobacco, and it is disturbing that it's still here, but considering all the issues that are with, that we're still spending on educating the public on tobacco, I imagine that there's a lot of other things that are going on that nobody really knows that much about, and that's what I wanted to spend the other half of the show on. So I guess what I wanted to, I've got several things I wanted to touch on, but maybe we can talk about some of the non-tobacco-related occupational toxins that are known to cause cancer in, you know, a variety of industries such as agriculture, you know, metalworks, et cetera. And perhaps you could just maybe speak to what concerns you the most and what are some of the things you want people to know about.
Well, in preparing for this, one of the first things I did, and you know, to have an informed public, I think is really important. The bottom line on these kinds of issues are the National Toxicology Program, and you can access that on the web. And that's what I did. I drew up the 11th report on carcinogens, and they break that down into what we know to be human carcinogen, and then ones that we think. And I think that's a great place for people to start when they're concerned.
So you're not talking about, is this NIOSH?
No, this is not.
Okay.
This is National Toxicology Program. It's part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Oh, what a great resource. And maybe when we break, I can give out that website.
Okay.
That's great. So what are we worried about?
Well, we're worried about a variety of things. One of the things that we talk quite a bit about that people aren't aware of would be benzene. Benzene is a solvent used in many chemical processes, and that's known to cause human leukemias. Other ones are similar to the same kinds of compounds in tobacco smoke, and they would be present also in, like, coal tars and coal oven emissions, those kinds of things.
So benzene... Benzene is a petroleum-related carcinogen?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And so what kind of, if it's petroleum-related, if anything that runs on petroleum, would that's what we're worried about?
There is that general idea, yes. And they have different, they work by different ways. But many of these compounds that come from petroleum are carcinogenic.
How does benzene get into your body? Are we breathing
it in? Oh, you can inhale it.
So you inhale it. Okay.
Oh, yeah. So in the factory.
Is it one of those, is it sort of like you inhale it, but also you can be, you know, it's in our groundwater and it's in, this is linked to leukemias. Who would be at risk? Are we all at risk for benzene?
Mm, No, I don't know if you remember. About 15 years ago, there was a scare that our mineral water, and I think it was one of the French ones, that was contaminated with benzene. And so that was a real scare because everybody was drinking it for their health.
Perrier.
Yes, it was. That's right.
It was a Perrier scare. Oh, dear.
And it was true.
Oh, God.
But
that was terrible.
It was trace amounts. So typically people aren't exposed to it unless they are working with these solvents.
I see. What about, I hear a lot about, so benzene basically is, benzene is linked to leukemia.
Mm-hmm.
What about diesel exhaust?
Well, diesel exhaust, I don't really enjoy going behind a bus either. But diesel exhaust for the same kinds of compounds, and usually that's by inhalation.
Okay, so these are sort of the inhalable. What about in the plastics industry, one of the things I hear a lot about are dioxins.
Right.
What is dioxin, and where does it come from, and why should we be worried about it?
Dioxin is what I work with in the lab, actually. Dioxin is formed usually when we incinerate, like hospital waste. It's also formed during the bleaching process as a paper, so around paper mills it's formed.
Okay.
In a number of combustion processes of wood and coal, it's formed.
Is it used in the plastics industry quite a bit?
No, I think you're thinking about phthalate esters.
Okay, so it's not. So dioxin is more of a waste product.
Yes.
And that's also, and what happens, where does it go, and how does it get into our bodies, and what does it do?
So the most famous exposure would have been last year, Viktor Yushchenko, who was.
That's right.
Yes, and so it's still on the website, you can look at his face. And the hallmark of that toxicity in humans is the chloracne. And so it's a reddening, persistent reddening, his face has kind of a bumpy appearance.
Okay. And so this is, so basically, is it linked to any particular types of cancers?
And the Vietnam vets, what seems to come out is the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, most commonly. But the data has been really confusing because then there was a chemical plant exposure in Seveso, Italy about over 20 years ago. And then you saw things like decreases in breast and uterine cancers in women. So it's been very confusing.
So the data is not,
the data is gender specific.
Sorry, the data's been, I'm sorry?
The data is gender specific.
Gender specific.
Yes.
And what has the funding been like to sort of look at the human health effects of some of these environmental toxins?
Really, it's been pretty good. I get my funding from the National Institute of Environmental Health, and that's the major institute that funds these kinds of projects.
So basically, we're not looking at a deficit of funding. To look at this, it's more...
Well, funding overall is down, so not this particular area.
But this isn't an area that's being specifically targeted for less funding than other areas. In other words, it is actually, it's taken seriously, and there is a lot of serious research into it.
Yes.
With the, some of the other occupational toxins I've heard about is sort of some of the mining-related carcinogens.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
And
mm-hmm.
So essentially then, in your opinion, are we doing a good job educating the public about these carcinogens?
Well, no, I think there's a lot of confusion, and I think part of the confusion is that the public has a hard time understanding risk. And so, for example, the risk will get out of whack. And so, for example, they'll smoke a cigarette, and then they'll worry about a carcinogen in their plastic bag.
I see.
Do you see?
Yeah. So it's very hard to explain. Would the risk be, obviously, the risk from cigarette smoke would be greater than, you're talking about sort of the leaching of organochlorines from plastic bags?
Phthalate esters, yeah.
How could you go into that a little bit more, how the whole organochlorines story works, and what are we talking about when we're talking about organochlorines, and I guess that includes PCBs?
Mm-hmm. Many of these compounds are part of industrial waste. Probably the most famous, and when they first came to light, was the Love Canal incident. Do you remember that?
I remember that. I'm sure a lot of listeners.
This was
79, is that right?
Oh, yes. This was when it was a landfill, and it was sold to developers. And people found that these barrels were coming up in their backyards, and they were filled with all of these compounds.
I see.
And so, and these compounds are still there, and they're in large concentrations, like the Hudson River is heavily contaminated still. They harm our fish supply. You can go out to the fish, and they have lots of tumors. And so it's well known that these do cause tumors. But the question is, how much is enough to be a serious concern in humans?
So they're known as, so they're basically persistent toxic substances.
Yes.
That are not going away, and we don't really have a good way to get rid of them.
Right. And in the human body, it takes about 7 to 10 years for your body to eliminate it. It loves to be in your fat, so that's why I always tell people, well, if you don't want to go on a diet, you tell people you don't want to liberate your stores.
There is a, so one of the, Sandra Steingraber, who, she's the author of a book called Living Downstream, talks a lot about the fat-soluble and water-soluble toxins.
Mm-hmm.
She had, and I think, yeah, it's also, it's a new argument for a low-fat diet. So what, so basically the more fat you have in your body, the more these, are we talking organochlorines, or are there other toxins that live in fat?
Most of those that are lipophilic, which would be even your polyaromatic hydrocarbons, if you've got that one on your list too, your organochlorine, so all of those are going to be fat-soluble.
Right. Okay. So now we're the long name that you just said that ends in hydrocarbons, which I have for short PAHs.
Right.
What are those exactly?
These are a group of compounds. The thing with a lot of these chemicals is they're often associated with each other. So you can even find the PAHs in cigarette smoke. So they'll be a component of cigarette smoke, of diesel exhaust, of your coal tar burning.
I see.
And even, you know, it's a good reason why you don't want to be having your nose over your coal grill too.
I see. We're going to have to take a break now. Again, we're talking to Dr. Holly Swanson, a toxicologist at the University of Kentucky. For more information about the primary prevention of cancer and environmental carcinogens, we suggest starting with my book, Stopping Cancer at the Source, available on Amazon. When we come back, we'll talk more about environmental toxins and also about carcinogenic substances in our environment that we may not know about. I'm Dr. Sarah Rosenthal, your host. For further information, visit me online at sarahhealth.com. All shows are archived on our site, as well as at Voice America Health and Wellness Network at voiceamerica.com. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Steps to a healthier you. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Your Health Press is a publishing company that specializes in unique books and hard-to-find health products, topics that mainstream publishers ignore due to rarity, stigma, or controversy. Looking for books on thyroid cancer, early menopause, ostomy, or other rare or embarrassing conditions? You'll find lots of unique topics at yourhealthpress.com. At yourhealthpress.com, all of our books are available exclusively online or via toll-free ordering, so you can purchase in privacy. No cash register syndrome or special ordering from your bookstore or library. Your Health Press titles are available at all online bookstores, including Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com. To browse the Your Health Press catalog of titles, search the list of authors, or purchase, visit YourHealthPress.com. For toll-free ordering, call 1-888-232-4444. Your Health Press, prescribed reading for today's niche market.
Growing Up in America explores the challenges, risks, benefits, and differences this generation of children face each day. Hosted by veteran pediatric emergency physician and father of four, Dr. Charles Muzica, this show is for parents, teens, and children. It crosses each generation. By exploring the unique aspects of matriculation within this current generation, we hope to find answers and ways of optimizing this experience for today's generation. Growing Up in America with Dr. Charles Muzica broadcasts each Tuesday at 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel.
Dad, can I ask you something?
Sure.
There's this girl I kind of like.
Say no more.
You just have to impress her. Okay, but how?
Just, I don't know, pick up a lot of heavy things around her.
Like what?
You know, desks, chairs, people. Grunt if you have to.
Grunt?
Yeah, be like, There you go.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. When you adopt a child from foster care, just being there makes all the difference. To learn more, call 1-888-200-4005. A public service announcement brought to you by Adopt US Kids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
Are you tired of being tired? Are you sick of sitting around while life passes you by? You can get back on track by tuning in to Voice America Health and Wellness every Monday at 12 p.m. Pacific Time. For Attracting Abundance, the energy of success with Carol Look. Attracting Abundance is the program that empowers you to finally break through your limiting beliefs and blocks and shows you how to succeed in all areas of your life, from improved financial abundance, health and weight problems, as well as your relationships. Don't wait another week to be joyful. Listen to Attracting Abundance, the energy of success with Carol Look, this Monday at 12 p.m. Pacific Time, right here on Voice America Health and Wellness.
A healthy dialogue for your lifestyle. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Welcome back to Sarah Health Radio with Dr. Sarah Rosenthal. If you have a question or comment, dial 866-472-5792. Now back to the show. Here's Dr. Sarah.
Hello, we are back. I'm Dr. Sarah Rosenthal, your host. Welcome back to Sarah Health with Dr. Sarah Rosenthal and our discussion of cancer and the environment. We're talking right now to Dr. Holly Swanson, a toxicologist from the University of Kentucky. We were talking about some of the known occupational toxins, or at least known to those who are toxicologists, perhaps not to the average consumer. And Dr. Swanson was mentioning in the break that there seems to be now some issues coming up with butter flavoring in popcorn, and people who work in these popcorn factories, I guess, that are putting it on the popcorn. Maybe you can tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, I don't really know exactly how it's all turning out to be. It's an issue that was raised a couple of years ago when they started to notice some of the workers, what was happening to them in their lungs. So it's during the inhalation of the when they put the butter flavoring on there. So it's going to be a hazard in your home when you make your popcorn, but because of the concentrations they're exposed to during their workplace.
So it's kind of a new and interesting twist on an occupational hazard.
Yeah.
Is this I mean, I know that we do have some, there is some information too on I think that there was a study in the 90s that looked at Chinese women who did a lot of wok cooking and were inhaling hot smoke from their woks. were also at risk of lung-related health effects.
Yes, and their homes are very poorly ventilated.
These are some of the things that we probably don't know about, what are some of the carcinogens at our in common carcinogens in our home that we should know more about that we don't think about?
I think the worst one is radon.
Radon, yeah.
Yeah. And I think here in Kentucky, because of the limestone, I think there's a relatively high level of radon.
And maybe, so radon, is my understanding, is kind of a natural toxin. It's not
That's
something
right.
that we made.
It
occurs naturally sort of deep in the earth and then sort of comes up into your basement. Is that
yes,
how it works?
That's it, yes.
And it's coming from rocks?
Yes.
Wow, so that's sort of an interesting. What about things like, are we sort of finished with asbestos? Is that no longer an issue? Is it still an issue?
It's really only an issue when you're taking out old insulation. And so in all of our newer homes, that's not what they use.
So So it's not, so it's not an issue for most people anymore, unless they're doing renovations or something. What about things like, are there toxins we should be concerned about in cleaning products?
The cleaning products are really relatively safe. When I teach my lectures to the medical students, what I stress more is when you have children and if they tend to want to drink things, and then they would drink acids or bases, and that's more like the short-term toxicity rather than the carcinogenic.
So it's not a carcinogenic issue.
No.
I guess one of the things I wanted to talk about, it's probably a bit of a lengthy discussion, is the issue of testing for toxicity.
Mm-hmm.
Well connected with a lot of people in the cancer prevention community, and I know that there's a lot of discussion on what's called the precautionary principle. You know, should we sort of assume that chemicals that we're sort of putting out there, should we make the assumption that they're toxic until proven otherwise? And science likes to do it the other way around, sort of the weight of evidence approach, sort of that we should assume that there's not a problem unless a problem comes up. And maybe you can speak to that. Correct me if I've made wrong assumptions.
No.
And tell me what we do. How do we test these things?
So let me first try to explain to you part of the problem. The problem about cancer in humans is that it takes 20 years to develop. So from your first exposure, then 20 years later, you'll develop cancer.
Okay.
And so trying to figure out that cause and effect relationship, that makes it difficult.
So that's why the weight of evidence approach is the only thing that you can really do in science.
Yes. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to get biomarkers so that we can identify something that happens much earlier than 20 years having a real tumor in your body.
I see. I understand that sort of the way we're testing for toxicity now involves we test on mice and rats and that,
mm-hmm.
and so sort of animal testing. How does that process work?
Usually, what happens, and again, that's why I mentioned the National Toxicology Program, because that's what they do. They take any of the compounds that are considered at risk, and if you go into that website, they talk about who can ask for them to be tested, and it really is anybody. The public can. And so usually what they do is you consider the lifetime of a mouse or rat. And so a mouse is going to be around 2 years. And then they're fed that compound for 2 years.
I see. And then you see what happens to them.
That's right. Yes, exactly. And, of course, we know we're not big mice.
Uh-huh. Are you giving them sort of a compound also at a much larger dose than what we would normally just have as humans being exposed to these compounds?
What we try to do is figure out what would be a normal amount of exposure based on the body weight.
Okay. So we're not giving them larger doses than what humans might be expected to be exposed to.
Not typically, but sometimes what they like to do is they like to add the high dose in there so that they can get some kind of idea of how it would change. You know, so maybe a high dose and a low dose.
I see. So for example, there are some, so like how did we figure out, for example, that benzene was a bad thing?
Oh, that was done from the epidemiology of the workers. And so somebody has to be observant is the first thing.
Okay.
And figure out that, look, there's all these workers in these plants, they have leukemias. Where is
okay.
it coming from?
So sometimes the way that we figure these things out is when there's kind of like an outbreak
That's right.
of a certain health effect, and then you sort of connect it to what they've been exposed to, and that takes a long time.
Yes.
Because
uh-huh.
because they have to be exposed for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on sort of taking a more precautionary approach are, and we chatted about this earlier today, but your thoughts are that it would somehow, that in other words, nothing would ever get, we'd never use anything because it would take 20 years to test everything?
No.
Sort of like drugs or?
Well, drugs you have to have, they have to be tested in all of the animal studies before any of the drug or food additives gets into the circulation. Those have to be tested. But if when we're talking about different chemicals, and, you know, I was thinking about one thing that's hot right now is nanoparticles.
And what's a nanoparticle?
A nanoparticle is a very small delivery system that they want to use for drugs.
I see.
And so the question is, how would that affect cancer?
I see.
And so that they're putting out many requests for proposals for that.
So we have different rules to test mm-hmm. food and drugs, and different rules for. What are we calling? What do we call a chemical that's just sort of released into the population without? What kinds of testing does it go through before it's released?
Well, if it's just in a regular manufacturing process, it probably wouldn't have a lot of testing.
So how is that defended? How come something that we breathe wouldn't require the same amounts of testing as something that we're eating or a drug that we're taking? Is there
well, it depends on how it's going to be used.
So if it's used in the manufacturing process and the general public is not going to be exposed to it at large, then
I'm really not as familiar with all the legal aspects here, so I don't want to say anything incorrect.
But basically what we do know is that there's different rules for what's released out there in the environment and what we're sort of breathing and what's used in the manufacturing processes and then what is actually available as food and drugs.
Yeah.
So those are the so we rely on epidemiology, which is kind of like counting and watching and making mm-hmm. connections. And we rely on some animal studies to see if
mm-hmm.
something's toxic.
Mm-hmm.
So the stuff that we know for sure, like, for example, what are we doing about benzene if we're worried about it?
We're trying to limit its use as much as possible.
So then we pass laws and try to make sure that. So I mean, these are the kinds of things that we did with, you know, the old style. We no longer have
DDT.
The fluorocarbons in the old air conditioners.
yes. And so, the PCEs that was used in the shoe industry.
So we've gotten rid of a lot of things this way, and it's just sort of a slower moving process. Is that sort of what we're looking at?
Yes, horrendously slow.
So essentially, then we're going to have to end our show, I think. This we can go on for a long time. I want to thank my guests today. First, we had on Dr. Ellen Hahn, a tobacco policy expert at the University of Kentucky. And we're just finishing a conversation with Dr. Holly Swanson, a toxicologist at the University of Kentucky, who I had to rudely cut off because we're going to go on and on about this topic. For more information on the primary prevention of cancer and environmental toxins, check out my book, Stopping Cancer at the Source, which is available on Amazon. Next week, our resident endocrinologist, Dr. Elena Christofides, based in Ohio, will be back to talk about type 2 diabetes in women. You can visit me online at sarahhealth.com. And remember, you are not alone.
Thank you for listening to Sarah Health Radio. To contact Dr. Rosenthal or one of her guests for more information, visit sarahhealth.com. Tune in next Thursday for another hour of Sarah Health Radio with Dr. Sarah Rosenthal.